Benedict Rogers of Christian Solidarity Worldwide, you've been out to Burma, the borders of Burma, and you've taken a particular interest in the situation in that country over the years, and you've written a book. The book's called A Land Without Evil. I just wonder why without evil when there is so much evil in that country?
Absolutely, it's a very good question. It's a deliberately paradoxical title. I chose the title because I discovered that the Karen people's word for their homeland, they call it Kothule, means a land without evil. And the Karen are one of the largest ethnic groups in Burma who are suffering huge amounts of evil at the moment.
You mentioned the Karen group as being one of the ethnic minorities. There are several groups, aren't there?
That's right. There are seven main groupings, the Karen, the Kareni, the Shan, the Mon, the Chin, the Kuchin, and the Arakan. But there are also hundreds of subgroups within those. And I think, I don't know the exact figure, but I think it's something like 130 or more ethnic groups in Burma, but under those seven main groupings.
Reading your book, what it helped me do, I suppose, is to see the historical context to Burma's troubled past. The Karenis, I guess, are one of the groups that felt very betrayed by the British, aren't they?
That's right. Both the Karen and the Kareni fought very loyally and very bravely alongside the British in the Second World War against the Japanese, and actually suffered a lot at the hands of not only the Japanese but the Burman majority who sided with the Japanese at that time. The Karen fought very loyally alongside Britain, and at the time Britain actually made some promises to them along the lines of promising them autonomy or even independence, and never fulfilled those promises at all, walked away from them.
What happened when independence actually came?
Well, in 1947, Aung San, who had been the leader of the independence movement, brought together some of the ethnic groups in Panglong, in Shan State, and they agreed to what became known as the Panglong Agreement, to develop a federal system for Burma, protecting the autonomy and the rights of ethnic groups. Aung San, unfortunately, was assassinated a few months after independence, and really from then on everything changed, and the Panglong Agreement was never implemented, and there was a period of democracy in the 1950s, and even under democracy the ethnic groups certainly suffered, but then things went really bad in 1962 when Ne Win seized power in a military coup, and Burma's been ruled by successive military regimes ever since.
Now, Ne Win is no longer with us, but he had a quite eccentric way of being, didn't he, particularly around numbers?
That's right. He, and in fact his successors today, have a real obsession with astrology, and he was very influenced by the advice of personal astrologers. And so, for example, he demonetized quite a lot of currency overnight because he believed that certain digits were unlucky numbers for him. Well, he believed that the number 9 was his lucky number, and therefore he scrapped all sorts of normal currency and brought out banknotes that were divisible by 9, a 90 chat banknote and that sort of thing, and so people lost savings overnight.
And I suppose one of the amazing thing has been the sheer brutality of the regimes over the decades in Burma.
Absolutely. I mean, I believe what is happening in some parts of Burma amounts to a form of attempted genocide. I don't use that word lightly because obviously it is a controversial word, but I think that the scale of destruction over the years and the underlying intent of the military regime shows that it is attempted genocide. Destruction of, since 1996, over 2,500 villages in eastern Burma alone have been destroyed. Over 1 million people are internally displaced, on the run, hiding in the jungle. There's widespread evidence of systematic use of forced labour, rape, use of people as human minesweepers. Burma has the highest number of forcibly conscripted child soldiers in the world, over 1,000, well over 1,000 political prisoners, widespread use of torture and so on. So it's a horrendous package of gross violations of human rights.
You yourself have met quite a lot of internally displaced people over your visits to the country. What are these stories that have touched you most?
Alongside the stories of real horrendous suffering is, in almost every case that I've come across, an incredible dignity and graciousness and faith and courage among the people that I've met. And I think of one person who's a school teacher in a village of internally displaced people across the border inside Karen State, and he just exudes a sort of calmness and almost joy about him that is totally at odds with the circumstances that he's living in. I remember every year we helped to organise the Global Day of Prayer for Burma, and this year we had events in London, but I was actually on the Thai-Burmese border and spent that day, the second Sunday in March, with an IDP village inside Burma, and they told me that morning that they had had reports that they could face another attack. They'd been burnt down many times before, and they just keep moving up river and rebuilding. They said they heard rumours that they might face an attack perhaps within 2 days from that day. And I sat there, and there was a group of people just playing on a guitar and singing, and there was no sense of panic or frenzy or even real fear. There was just this remarkable serenity about them, which was very strange given what they knew they might expect within 2 days. Thankfully, that attack actually didn't come, but they could face it at any time.
You've also met a lot of people fighting the resistance, haven't you?
I have, yes. I've had the privilege a number of times of going into the camps of Karen and Kareni and Shan resistance soldiers. And what I find about them is that they're really fighting a struggle to defend their people. None of them want to be in this war. They're not aggressive fighters, and they're very brave and very good fighters, but incredibly poorly equipped. But they're really the only line of defence that the people have, and if it weren't for them, I think many more villages would have been wiped out.
You spent some time with the Free Burma Rangers. Who are they, and what do they do, and what have they managed to achieve so far?
Well, they're an incredible group, one of the most inspiring groups that I know working in that region. They were founded by a Westerner whose real name can't be disclosed, but he goes by a Karen name, which is Thau Wa Apa, and I've been practicing that over the years, and which means Father of the White Monkey, and the explanation of that is in my book. But he founded the group, but the teams themselves are from the different ethnic nationalities, Karen, Shan, Kareni, and so on. And their motto is to bring help, hope, and love to the people in the conflict areas. They go much deeper inside Burma than any other aid organisation that I know of, and they go at huge risk to their lives. They've had many stories of times where they've been fired at by the Burma army, been surrounded by the Burma army, had to escape, and they've had some pretty miraculous escapes. But basically what their work is about is, on a practical level, taking in medical supplies to the internally displaced people in the conflict zones, very often responding to an attack within a few hours or a day or so of the attack to document what's happened. And I've just today been receiving reports, as I have over the last several weeks, of killings, of burnt houses, which they are able to get to photograph, interview the survivors, and get the information out. So taking medical aid, documenting the violations, and then the more intangible aspect of their work is really what they describe as just sort of being alongside people in their suffering. The founder of the Free Burma Rangers puts it very well when he says that very often he's with people who've lost everything, and he has to say to them, I have nothing to offer you. I can't change your situation. I can't solve the problem. All I can do is say to you that I'm with you and you're not forgotten. and that the world does know of your plight. And he believes that's actually an incredibly important dimension to their work. And I would confirm that. In my experience, the people I've met say to me, you know, the fact that you've come and you're with us shows us that we're not forgotten.
Over the decades of oppression in Burma and the horrific events, one of the worst periods seems to have been in the late 1980s.
That's right. In about 1987, people started to express their deep dissatisfaction with the regime, particularly after Ne Win demonetized some of the currency and people lost life savings overnight. And that then grew into 1988, which saw widespread public protests in support of democracy. And that culminated on the most famous date is known as 8/8/88, the 8th of August 1988, when thousands of people were slaughtered by the Burma army as they were peacefully protesting in scenes very similar to Tiananmen Square a year later in China. Thousands were killed. That was then followed a couple of years later by the regime deciding to, rather surprisingly, to hold an election in 1990. And my speculation is that they thought they could legitimize themselves by holding an election, which through intimidation they thought they would win. In fact, the people, despite huge intimidation, stood very firmly for democracy and elected the National League for Democracy and the Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi as the winners. They won over 80% of the seats in parliament. But the regime then rejected the results and imprisoned most of the victors. Aung San Suu Kyi herself is under house arrest still now. But those events in 88 and 1990 were very important in Burma's history.
The catalogue of terror carried out by the ironically named SPDC, the State Peace and Development Council, how do you personally make sense of the level of depravity that humankind is capable of?
I find it very, very hard to make sense of it. I can understand in a conflict situation, even a totally unjust conflict that the regime has inflicted upon the people, I can understand soldiers shooting and killing and doing what soldiers do in conflict situations. What I find impossible to understand, really, is the, and you use the word depravity, and that's absolutely right, the beheadings, the gruesome stories of babies being put in rice pounders and crushed to death, people being killed and then people being attacked and you know, cut open and their heart taken out or their liver taken out. Those sort of really depraved acts, widespread use of rape and particularly gang rape, many reports of women who have been subjected to rape by, you know, 5 or 10 or more soldiers in succession. Those sort of things I find impossible to understand, really.
Benedict Rogers. I also asked Lord David Alton about the experiences that he'd heard of on his visits to the Burma border.
On both occasions that I've travelled to the Burma border, and on the first occasion I illegally went into the Karen state, I've taken first-hand accounts from people of the experiences that they have suffered, but I've also collected reports that have been drawn up by Karen, Kareni, Shan, Hmong people about the experiences that they've endured. Amongst the first-hand accounts that I've received are reports from people who have been used as human landmine sweepers. Before the Burmese military will go into an area, because landmines have been laid there, they'll use people to go through the area, to clear the area of landmines, and obviously those people are killed or injured in the process. I visited one of the prosthesis centres where some of those who have survived have been treated. I've met with Karen women's groups who have produced an extraordinary report, incredibly well documented, about how rape has been used as a weapon of war by the Burmese military on a systematic and very brutal basis. On my last visit, I met children who had been orphaned, one little boy aged 8 who'd seen his mother and his father shot dead in front of him, and he was then sold to a family in Thailand over the border, and he ran away from them, and he managed to get back to one of the refugee camps, and I taught him in that camp, and alongside him were 4 other children brothers and sisters whose parents had likewise been executed by the Burmese military. And I've been in camps which have been attacked from across the border by the Burmese military, and one camp I visited was subsequently razed to the ground. It was burnt to the ground by the Burmese military. I've also taken evidence from women whose husbands had been taken as forced labour, as slaves, used as porters, and who've become ill, not been treated, and have just become exhausted and allowed to die in the course of that forced labour. So there are serial human rights abuses which should be categorised as genocide. That's what it constitutes, and I'm amazed that the world community has not done that. And it's an issue that I've raised on a number of occasions now with the British government, but it's also one I've raised with the American State Department, and I hope that in due course the world will realise that the atrocities being committed in the Karen state certainly fall under the official category of genocide. And once that label has been fixed, of course all sorts of things then flow from that, not least that those members of the Burmese military who have failed to deliver political reforms anyway, which is one of the reasons why we haven't described as genocide what is taking place, because we've left open, as it were, a scope for internal reform. Well, they haven't delivered internal reform, and that should not be a trade-off given what it is that they have been responsible for, and I think they should be held to account before international courts, just as Milosevic has been, for the things that they have done against their own people.
And you've come across some very inspiring campaigning people over there. Can you just tell us a bit about them?
It is remarkable that in so many situations where there is chaos, where there's such hardship and suffering, that there is a spirit, first of all, of endurance, but also it seems to throw up people who take on the role of making sense of the chaos. And I've been inspired by some of the people I've met. During my last visit, for instance, I met some of the students who had been arrested and spent, in one case, 9 years, another case, 7 years in prison in Burma, and who are now working for democracy and running one of the organisations for the promotion of democracy inside Burma, working with the National League for Democracy. But I also met people doing practical things. A nun who set up a school, and thanks to the support of some churches here in the United Kingdom, I'm glad to say that work has been expanded in the last 3 years, so that she's now got 600 children whom she's educating to a very high standard, and providing an opportunity for children who would not otherwise be able to have any kind of further education.
In terms of global politics, why do you think the Burmese plight has been largely ignored?
Neville Chamberlain once famously remarked about Czechoslovakia that it was a faraway country about which we knew very little, and for that reason he was against us engaging against the Nazis, because he said there were no great British interests involved there. And the truth is, of course, that the world doesn't have great interests in Burma. Yes, there's teak, there's oil, there are interesting deposits of minerals that will no doubt be exploited in due course, and there will be tourism. But they can find most of those things in other places. So on the whole, apart from a few notorious companies such as Total and Premier Oil, who I'm glad to say have now disengaged from Burma, but generally speaking, the country is seen as being pariah-like, and so there isn't a great deal of Western investment. And the United States, to their credit, have a total embargo on new investment in Burma, so no American companies can invest there. On the other hand, Japan certainly has interest in the country, and China has a very substantial presence in Burma, but not to an extent that it's been able to revitalise their economy. What was potentially one of the best economies in Southeast Asia 50 years ago is now the poorest economy in Southeast Asia, and people are living often in situations of near starvation and deep poverty, and that's been because of the blind policies that have been pursued by the Burmese junta over these years. And I can't see any end to that until that junta is overthrown.
And what do you feel ordinary people can actually do to bring about change?
There are a number of things that ordinary people can do to bring about change in Burma. The temptation is to feel a bit like the little boy in Robert Louis Stevenson's book. You remember the one who says, "The world is so big and I'm so small, I do not like it at all, at all." I mean, you can feel there's nothing I can do about this. It's just too remote. There's, you know, I can't personally achieve anything. And they would be wrong to think that. When I was recently on the Burma-Thai border, I met some British women who were there doing some teaching work, who brought some aid out and who were personally engaged with some of the Karen people there, giving them some very practical support. But if you don't feel able to travel, with the risks involved in going to that part of the world, there are other practical things that people can do. The Jubilee campaign provides a campaign pack, for instance, of actions people can take, one of which is to write to your Member of Parliament or to write to the Foreign Secretary asking why we do not have the same policy as the United States on total embargo of investment in Burma, but also, more importantly, demanding that charges of genocide should be laid at the door of the military junta. And I think that there is more than enough material to justify the categorization of the crimes that have taken place there as crimes against humanity and as real genocide. Through local amnesty groups, people can campaign for the same sorts of objectives. So there are many things people can do, even if it is only writing a letter or picking up the telephone to the Burmese ambassador in London. When James Maudsley was in prison, I encouraged people to ring the embassy and to get 10 other people to do the same. Within 2 days, their telephone lines were jammed. They were furious about this. They're not used to public opinion and Western pressure being placed upon them, and we should do more of it.
Lord David Alton, I asked Benedict Rogers about the recent developments in Burma, and particularly the plans to dam the Salween, Southeast Asia's largest free-flowing river.
What is being proposed is a series of dams which affect both Karen and Kareni, and to some extent Shan areas, and the effect will be devastating for the local people and the local environment. Many villages will be simply submerged underwater. The whole vast areas will be flooded, and there's a very good report that details exactly, you know, how wide the area is, and that's called Dammed by Burma's Generals, I believe. Listeners could find that online. But the effect will be that it will displace thousands of people. In past experience with dam projects, the military always comes in to sort of protect the construction process, and with the military come all the associated human rights violations, rape, torture, forced labour, and so on, and that almost certainly will happen as a result of this, and it will destroy much of the environment. And economically, the proposal is that the dams will generate electricity that will be sold to Thailand. So Thailand will get the electricity, the regime will get the money, and the people will not see any of the benefit at all.
And bizarrely, the regime seems to have moved the capital.
That's right. It happened sort of fairly overnight, just a few months ago, and everybody that I speak to say that there are really two or three main reasons why the regime has done this. First of all, it goes back to their obsession with astrology, and it's believed that there was astrological advice that this year was not going to be a good year for them in Rangoon, that this place, Pinmanar, had you know, the right vibes about it, and therefore they were advised to move there. Secondly, there is an amazing paranoia on the part of the regime about the possibility of a US or international military intervention, which, as much as I would quite like it to happen, it isn't remotely on the world's agenda. But the regime, I think, after Iraq, genuinely is paranoid about the US intervening in Burma. And the third explanation, which is perhaps the most rational, is that the new location, Pinmanar, is in the centre of the country and gives them much easier access to all the surrounding ethnic groups in the border regions, both eastern and western borders.
I suppose one of the questions, Ben, that one keeps asking is, why haven't we done more about the Burmese situation?
Well, that's a very good question. I think there are probably a number of reasons for it, one of which I think is that the media has not covered Burma in anything like as much depth as it could have done, and the way it's covered other tragedies around the world. And that's partly because it's been very difficult to access Burma. It's partly that the suffering has been, apart from some events like the massacres in 1988, the suffering has been a sort of steady trickle of suffering, rather than the killing of thousands of people that we saw in Rwanda or Kosovo that catch the headlines overnight. I never quite know whether there's not enough vested interest or too much vested interest. In some ways, you could say that Britain and America and other countries don't have enough economic or strategic interest in Burma to make it worth their while to do something about it. But you could also say, you could also point to the examples of the French oil company Total, which has invested in a big gas pipeline that Aung San Suu Kyi herself has described as one of the single largest sources of revenue for the regime. And there is a belief that Total's investments in Burma have held up, have caused the French to be much more cautious, and that in turn has caused the EU not to be as robust as it could have been. So, plus there's obviously the influence of China and people's concern about China and Burma's other neighbours who've been both very weak and also have been complicit with the regime, Thailand, India, and other parts of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. I'd like, if I may, just to address the issue of what could be done. And I think one of the most urgent things, there was a report commissioned last year by the former Czech president Václav Havel and Bishop Desmond Tutu from South Africa, and they commissioned a law firm to look at the case for bringing the issue of Burma to the UN Security Council agenda, and the report came out. It was called Threat to the Peace, and it was a brilliant piece of research looking at past precedents for UN Security Council discussion of an issue. And it's shocking that the UN Security Council has never once addressed the issue of Burma. Following the release of that report, there was an intensive lobbying campaign that I and many others were involved in around the world. And that resulted just before Christmas in a preliminary discussion, not in a formal UN Security Council agenda, but by the Security Council, sort of an informal briefing. And that was a very good first step. That's a lot more than had happened until then. But I think what the international community needs to work towards now is a full UN Security Council discussion of Burma, leading to a resolution. And the proposal at the moment is a resolution that would be a relatively mild resolution. It would simply require the regime to engage in dialogue with the National League for Democracy and the ethnic groups, and move towards a transition to democracy. The advantage of having such a resolution is not necessarily that the regime is going to put its hands up and comply, but that if they don't comply, because a Security Council resolution is legally binding, further action could follow if they don't comply. So I think that's the thing the international community needs to do now and really needs to pull together on.
Benedict Rogers of Christian Solidarity Worldwide. And details of his book can be found by following the link on the feature page.